From feature story news in Washington and our bureaus around the world, this is FSN Reports. I'm Simon Marks. Today on the program, as John Kerry seeks coalition partners for the president's war on Islamic State, the man who ran things in Iraq after Saddam Hussein's ouster tells us the White House is on the wrong track.
He said we're not going to have soldiers in combat in Iraq. You shouldn't fight a war by saying what you're not going to do.
Also today, Oscar Pistorius facing a lengthy jail sentence after being convicted of culpable homicide. Northern Ireland marks the death of a firebrand preacher who eventually embraced compromise. And remembering Donald Sinden, one of the world's finest exponents of Shakespeare.
You sulfurous and thought-executing fires! Singe my white head!
High drama ahead on FSN Reports after our summary of the day's main news.
From Feature Story News in Washington, I'm Nina Marepotz for the latest world news. The High Court in South Africa has ruled that Paralympic athlete Oscar Pistorius did not murder his girlfriend Reeva Steenkamp when he shot her through a bathroom door on the 14th of February last year. But the athlete was negligent and has been found guilty of culpable homicide. He's been bailed until sentencing on the 13th of October, as Gary Alfonso reports.
Judge Thokozile Masipa ruled that the state had not proved beyond any reasonable doubt that Pistorius murdered Reeva Steenkamp after an argument. She said Pistorius showed clearly that he did not intend to shoot his girlfriend and that he tried to save her after he shot her. She said the unanimous decision of the court was to acquit the athlete of the murder charge, but to find him guilty of culpable homicide. He was also found guilty of a lesser charge of firing a loaded firearm in a public place, but acquitted on two other charges related to firing a gun through a car sunroof and illegally owning ammunition. Gary Alfonso, Pretoria.
The United States has added Russia's largest bank, Sberbank, to an expanded list of sanctioned entities related to Moscow's involvement in Ukraine. The move is likely to lead to much higher borrowing costs for Russian consumers and institutions. It's part of an EU-coordinated new round of sanctions targeting key Russian sectors, including energy, finance and defense. From Washington, Daniel Rentschus reports.
The financial sanctions squeeze Sberbank and six other major Russian banks by preventing US persons or entities from providing anything but short-term financing with a limit of 30 days or providing equity. Additionally, the US is stopping the exportation of a wide array of technology goods, services and financing to Russia's five biggest energy companies to curb the ability to continue frontier oil exploration. The sanctions also prevent dealings with Rostec, a major Russian defense exporter. All these sanctions have been arranged in coordination with the European Union, and officials say they can only be rolled back if Russia complies with all 12 sections of a recent Ukraine peace plan formulated in Minsk. Daniel Rentschus, Washington.
Moscow is now expected to retaliate with further sanctions of its own, as Jack Parrott reports from Moscow.
Moscow says it will act with appropriate force to international sanctions imposed upon it, which could include banning car imports into Russia and even closing Russian airspace to international flights. Despite Russia's struggling economy, the Kremlin has said that some of the sanctions measures are more positive than negative.
Toronto's mayor, Rob Ford, has withdrawn his name from the Toronto mayoral race, but not because of drug abuse. His campaign has replaced his name on the ballot with his brother. Doug Ford, a city councillor, has cited his brother's health as the reason for his withdrawal. Rob Ford is being treated for a tumour and is said to be facing 6 to 8 weeks of chemotherapy and surgery. From bureaus worldwide, this is FSN. Dr. Ian Paisley, one of the most significant figures in Northern Ireland and its peace process, has died at the age of 88. The Protestant preacher and politician spent years refusing any compromise with a terrorist group, the IRA, but he later entered Northern Ireland's government at Stormont with Sinn Féin in a power-sharing deal in 2007. Ollie Barrett reports.
Ian Paisley earned the nickname Dr. No because of his staunch unionism and opposition to compromise with Republicans. He opposed a series of political deals, including the Anglo-Irish and Good Friday agreements, but he did finally enter the peace process and became Northern Ireland's First Minister. His wife, Baroness Eileen Paisley, says he died on Friday morning and that his family is heartbroken. Sinn Féin's Martin McGuinness, one-time opponent but later his Deputy First Minister, paid tribute to the latter days of his political life and their friendship. Ollie Barrett, London.
The first British person to contract the Ebola virus says he will return to Africa, where he was infected, to continue helping others fight the disease. William Pooley was flown back to the UK from Sierra Leone by the RAF last month to receive specialist treatment. Our UK correspondent Dan Whitehead reports.
The 29-year-old made a full recovery at a hospital in North London after receiving the experimental drug ZMapp. He's now been discharged and says he wants to travel back to Sierra Leone within a few weeks to continue volunteering, adding that he believes it is likely he is now immune to the deadly virus. Mr. Pooley has also urged the UK Prime Minister David Cameron to take global leadership in helping improve hospital resources in the affected regions. Around half of the 3,000 people who've been infected with Ebola in Africa have died.
And that's the latest from Feature Story News. I'm Nina Maria Potts reporting.
From Feature Story News in Washington, I'm Simon Marks. Welcome to FSN Reports. Secretary of State John Kerry is in Turkey tonight, continuing the quest to build what President Obama says must be a broad coalition to battle Islamic State militants in Iraq and Syria. At the White House today, attention turned back to Russia, the administration announcing a range of tough new sanctions that target banks, energy and defense companies over Moscow's aggression towards Ukraine. But next week, a round of congressional hearings will put the focus back on Islamic State, after the CIA said yesterday it now believes there are at least 30,000 militants backing the organization on the ground. We spoke today with Ambassador Paul Bremer, the man who was appointed to run Iraq by President George W. Bush after the ouster of Saddam Hussein. FSN's Lorna Shaddock began by asking him for his view on the president's Wednesday night speech.
I think he deserves credit for making a tough decision for him to get back into the war in Iraq. That's what it is. And he laid out a strategy about which there are two questions. First of all, it seems to me there's a question about whether he laid out this strategy because the opinion polls, the bottom had gone out of his public opinion approval, and he's facing a midterm election in 2 months. So did he do this because he wanted to shore up his political base, or did he do this because he really believes in the program? And I don't think we know the answer. I think there's an incomplete grade on that. Second problem is there's a conceptual flaw at the base of it, I think, which is that these terrorists, ISIL, is just another radical group, as he called them, and therefore they can be dealt with, as he said, the way we've dealt with them in Somalia and the Yemen. The trouble is Somalia and Yemen are not successes. So we have a problem in the first case, the most important one of the credibility. Is the president really mean it this time? And secondly, has he correctly defined the problem or the solution to the problem?
What then would you posit is the best solution to this?
Well, I have been in favor of more aggressive action in Syria for more than 3 years. And it's a textbook example of the lesson that's always there in foreign policy, which is that a difficult decision delayed often leads to a much more difficult decision later. At this point, three things have to happen, all of which are elements of the president's policy. One, arming, providing the Kurds with heavy weapons, and by the way, with airlift. The Kurds are defending a 1,000-kilometer front. They need to be able to move their troops around. They're pretty good troops, but they got to be able to move them. They need intelligence and planning help and so forth. Secondly, we need to work hard now with the new Iraqi government to reconstitute the army, which Prime Minister al-Maliki devastated by essentially getting rid of many of the American-trained officers right down to the brigade level. And that explains why this army, which defeated al-Qaeda in 1909, collapsed in 2014. And thirdly, the president, again, correctly, I think, is expanding the air attack into Syria. But we can't do this alone. We need allies.
And you mentioned there in your second point the army, and something that's been brought up quite a lot recently is your decision to disband the Iraqi army,
right,
back in 2003, many saying that is now the root of this problem with ISIS. What's your defense against that when presumably many people have been bringing this up.
Right.
Effectively saying it's your fault in the first place.
Yeah, well, let's take a minute to look at the reality. First of all, the mistake I made was using the verb disband, because if actually there was no Iraqi army on the ground anywhere. There was not a unit standing to battle, or to order anywhere in the country, actually a month before I got there. We decided to build rather than recall the old army, which would have led to an immediate civil war, we decided to build a new army. That new Iraqi army, with American help, defeated al-Qaeda in Iraq by the end of 2009. When President Obama came into office, both he and his vice president said, we have inherited an Iraq which is at peace, which has defeated al-Qaeda. So whatever mistakes may have been made in 2003, they were corrected by 2009. What has changed? The serious mistake President Obama made of pulling American troops out of Iraq at the end of 2011, which gave al-Maliki the signal to start a violently sectarian political program. Within 24 hours of our decision to pull out, he put out an arrest warrant for his Sunni vice president, who is still in exile in Turkey. He began this purge of the officer corps that I mentioned. He stopped cooperating with the Kurds. So what has happened is largely due to to the 2010 election, which al-Maliki actually didn't win. We supported his second term, and then the withdrawal of American forces. So whatever mistakes I may have made in 2003 are not the cause of what's happening in 2014. I mean, the history of the timeline is pretty clear.
Is it not the case that there were, even if there weren't official army units to disband, there were a lot of young men, extremely disaffected, with weapons, who have now been seen to be the rump of what became ISIS now?
Well, first of all, one of the elements of the decision to build a new army was to provide pensions to all the officers of the old army, which we did. We started paying pensions 2 months after I got there. Those pensions were continued. By the way, they were set at a level higher than these people would have gotten under Saddam. They continued throughout the time of the occupation. They had been continued under successive Iraqi governments. So the idea these people had no money is simply wrong. We also paid a one-time separation fee to all of the draftees. Thirdly, we said anybody in the old army up to the level of colonel was welcome to apply for a job in the new army. By the time I left Iraq, 14 months later, 80% of the officers and NCOs were from the old army. So we didn't exclude them. Of course, it was a smaller army because it was set up, at least initially, to be a defensive army, defending the borders, not to deal with an insurgency. So I know this is one of the prevailing myths. The trouble is people are not looking at the facts.
Moving away then from just the army issue, the whole invasion in 2003 clearly in some ways has destabilized the region to the extent that we now see the ISIS problem. Do you have any regrets looking back about the decision to go into Iraq at all, given what has happened in the region since then?
No, I don't. I think the president and our allies, particularly the British, took the right decision in 2003, given the facts as they were presented to them by both of our intelligence agencies, and by the way, by the French, Germans, and Russian intelligence services, none of whose governments in the end supported the invasion. There was a pervasive view that Saddam was working on WMD based on the record. So I think a reasonable man as president would have taken the decision Bush did. I think Iraq is in fact better off without Saddam Hussein, and I think we are. I think we'd be facing a much more complicated situation today with Saddam Hussein still in power in Iraq. And final point, one can't ignore the violence in Iraq. But the fact of the matter is, during his 20 years as dictator, Saddam Hussein killed something like 1.5 million Iraqis. That's 75,000 Iraqis every year. The violence since then has never reached anything like that level. Today, Iraqis have a per capita income that is 6 times what it was when I arrived in 2003. I'm not saying that everything's perfect in Iraq. It's obviously not, but I'm saying it's actually, if you step back and look at it from a little bit of distance, I think we're better off that Saddam is no longer there.
And of course, another problem that some are bringing up in terms of intervention is that Iraq was relatively self-contained when America went in 2003. Syria is a problem that is already spilling over into borders. It is engulfing the entire region. If the US gets involved, who knows what kind of a quagmire it's going to get bogged down into.
Well, if we look at the situation, what's happening here, of course, is the collapse of the Sykes-Picot arrangement in 1916. Basically, the whole region is going to need a makeover of some kind. There's going to have to be, at the end of all of this, when the music stops, if it ever stops, there's going to have to be a new concert of nations that addresses the question of the area between the Mediterranean and the Persian boundary. Of course, ISIL has an answer for that, which is called the Islamic Caliphate. That basically is what it, when they say the Levant, they mean Lebanon, Syria, Jordan, Palestine, Israel, Iraq, and maybe parts of Saudi Arabia. It's not all that clear about that. But that's why this is such a threat to the region. We can't allow that Islamic vision, that extremist vision, to be what is the outcome. We're going to have to find another solution, whether it involves, how it involves the borders that were put there 100 years ago. I mean, I don't know, but it's going to have to be addressed.
And of course, this is going to be a long-term problem and something that President Obama's successor, whoever they may be, will have to deal with as well.
Well, the president was correct and clear when he said the other night that this is going to be a long-term problem. I don't know why he said 3 years. I don't know what's magic about 3 years, except that he won't be in office anymore. But you shouldn't fight a war by saying what you're not going to do. Effectively, as he did with pulling the troops out of Iraq, as he now repeated again he's going to do in Afghanistan, he's given the enemy a deadline when we're no longer going to be in Afghanistan. He said we're not going to have combat or soldiers in combat in Iraq. Even if those things are true, why would you tell the enemy all you got to do is wait 3 years and we'll say it's finished or it's not finished, or we're not going to put combat forces in? Those kinds of statements raise the fundamental question on which this entire issue hinges. Can the president credibly make the case that he's really willing to see this through? And that, to me, is still the open question.
Ambassador Paul Bremer talking there to FSN's Lorna Shaddock in Washington. This is FSN Reports. In South Africa, the Paralympic athlete Oscar Pistorius was convicted today of culpable homicide in the death of his girlfriend, Reeva Steenkamp. The judge in the case said prosecutors had failed to prove that Pistorius was guilty of murder, but the lesser charge could still see him facing a substantial prison sentence, up to a maximum possible 15 years. He was also convicted on an unrelated charge of negligently handling a firearm. FSN's South Africa Bureau Chief Gary Alfonso was back in court today.
Well, the sentiment has been very mixed in South Africa. Many people saying, especially on social media, that money buys you a good defense, and that if you had been a poor man, or if it was a poor man who killed his girlfriend, he would have gotten life for murder. Others saying that justice prevailed, and that it was just a tragic accident. Friends of Reeva Steenkamp were visibly disappointed outside court. Her mother and father not saying anything, leaving reporters behind and walking out without having any comment. But Pistorius's uncle Arnold, who spoke to the media and highlighted afterwards, after the proceedings today, that they did not feel there were any victims in this case, only loss. So not thinking that Oscar got away with murder, but obviously that the loss of Reeva Steenkamp was something that was affecting everybody. But in legal circles, the sense was that Judge Thokozile Masipa summarized it very well. She said, according to the indictment was, the charge was that Oscar Pistorius tried to murder his girlfriend. She said the state did not prove that. and culpable homicide was the only plausible verdict. And in her summary, she also referred specifically to words like hastily and negligent in the firing of that firearm through the bathroom door. And that means she could be looking at aggravating circumstances when it comes to sentencing. So South Africans might still find the justice they seek when it comes to the sentencing.
Now, there appeared to be some long delays, and the judge called the legal teams to her chambers on several occasions when the discussion of bail and sentencing arose. Why did all that happen?
When it came to extending Oscar Pistorius's bail, the state immediately opposed the extension of it, saying that Oscar Pistorius is now a flight risk and that he's been found guilty of a serious crime. He sold all his properties in South Africa for what the defense argued was to pay his legal fees. And the state then argued that Pistorius was a danger to himself and others, citing cases where Pistorius went to a nightclub in Johannesburg and got into a confrontation with patrons during the time he was supposed to be under psychiatric evaluation, and also being quoted in newspapers as saying that he felt like taking his own life. So the judge then called them to her chambers, and when they returned, she said the state can argue at any time that Pistorius is in breach of bail conditions or that he should not be on bail, but she extended it. So he is out on bail, and during this period, it must also be recalled that it was the first time that Pistorius was actually taken to the holding cells after he had been found guilty of culpable homicide and didn't sit with his family and his legal team during the lunch break. So that was already a scare for Pistorius in terms of the seriousness of what is happening at the moment. The judge then also announced that the court will resume for argument in mitigation and aggravation of sentence on October 13th, and the rest of that week has been set aside for this very serious sentencing process.
And what's likely to happen when the court reconvenes for sentencing? What sort of sentence is Oscar Pistorius facing, if any?
The state will no doubt argue that the harshest possible sentence should be handed to Oscar Pistorius because of what they highlighted during the trial as an aggressive, gun-toting young man who did not respect women. Prosecutor Gerinel will probably also highlight that Pistorius should be facing a murder sentence and perhaps sending the judge a signal that if the sentence is too light, the National Prosecuting Authority will appeal the verdict and ask a higher court to overturn her ruling that murder in the second degree, or dolus eventualis, as they called it in court, was not in play. So the defense will highlight Oscar Pistorius's vulnerability as a disabled person who stands no taller than a 10-year-old when, without his prosthetic legs, rampant crime in South Africa, which makes reasonable people do unreasonable things, and the fact that Oscar Pistorius has no previous convictions and has been a model citizen, winning South Africa global accolades and gold medals. So culpable homicide verdicts in South Africa are very unpredictable. They will go strictly according to each case, and in this case, the judge will decide when they get back in that courtroom on October 13th.
Gary Alfonso, FSN's South Africa Bureau Chief. One of the most controversial figures in the modern history of Northern Ireland died today. The Reverend Ian Paisley was 88, and in a time of great change in the province, his personal journey took him from being a firebrand Protestant preacher, opposed to any kind of accommodation with his Catholic opponents, all the way to becoming Northern Ireland's First Minister, leading a government executive that shared power with those who once conspired against him. From FSN's London Bureau, Ollie Barrett reports.
Ian Paisley earned the nickname Dr. No because of his staunch unionism and his opposition to compromise with Republicans.
We say never! Never! Never!
In 1968, he was sent to prison, found guilty of organising an illegal march. Protesters took to the streets on his behalf, and when he was later released, he was greeted as a hero by supporters.
No surrender! God save the king!
He became a hugely well-known figure in British politics. In 1993, when an MP at Westminster, he was suspended from the House of Commons for accusing the then Northern Ireland Secretary of lying about secret government contacts with the IRA, a terrorist organisation.
As a long-standing member of this House, as a senior statesman and parliamentarian, to order, I do ask him to oblige this House and to oblige the Chair by withdrawing the word falsehood. I would be most obliged if he would do that.
Madam Speaker, I would like to stay in this House, But there are far too many issues in Northern Ireland that weigh on me at this time. And the people of Northern Ireland would say to me, why did you not stand by what you said outside the House? And I stand by what I said. It was a falsehood. It was worse. It was a lie.
Order. In accordance with the power given me by Standing Order number 42, I have to order the Honourable Member to withdraw immediately from the entire House.
But he did finally enter the peace process, a peace process which continues in Northern Ireland. Current leader of Britain's opposition Labour Party, Ed Miliband, has been paying tribute to the position he took in the end after years of opposition to compromise.
Many people will recognise that he made a very significant contribution to the peace we have in Northern Ireland and the extraordinary advances that that country has seen. A formidable politician, absolutely, and somebody who recognised the benefits and the importance of peace.
And Northern Ireland journalist Eamon McDermott says the crucial moment in Dr Paisley's career was towards the end of it.
If you look back on Ian Paisley's long and checkered career within Northern Ireland politics, it was really in the very late stages of his life that he could point to anything that was seen as an achievement. He was very much the no politician. He was opposed to everything that came along. He was seen as very much a divisive force for an awful long period of his time.
But Ian Paisley's death brings what many in Northern Ireland thought for years they would never hear. Sinn Féin's Martin McGuinness says he has lost a friend. Ollie Barrett, London.
Finally tonight, we are also remembering one of the world's greatest performers of Shakespeare, who died today in Britain. Sir Donald Sinden was 90, and he was a towering presence on the London stage and on British television for much of the last 60 years. His range as an actor was extraordinary, and one of his sons said today that between 1942 and 2008, he had only been out of work for a total of 5 weeks. He starred alongside the late Elaine Stritch in a popular British sitcom called Two's Company. He played a senior judge in the BBC legal drama Judge John Deed. His voice, immediately recognisable, was used in a variety of advertising campaigns, but it is for Shakespeare that he will be best remembered, here performing King Lear's soliloquy on the moor in a raging storm for the London Weekend television broadcast Playing Shakespeare.
Blow, winds, and crack your cheeks. Rage, blow. You cataracts and hurricanoes, spout till you have drenched our steeples, drowned the cooks. You sulphurous and thought-executing fires, vault couriers of oak-cleaving thunderbolts, singe my white head. And thou, all shaking thunder, strike flat the thick rotundity of the world. Crack nature's molds, all germens, spill at once that makes ingrateful man.
Sir Donald Sinden, dead at 90. His family said today that he was the last person alive who personally knew Oscar Wilde's lover, Lord Alfred Douglas. Donald Sinden leaves a remarkable legacy, establishing his own importance in the connective tissue of live drama. And that's FSN Reports for another week. I'm Simon Marks. For everyone with FSN everywhere, thanks for listening. Enjoy the weekend. And we'll see you on Monday. From Washington, goodbye.